So I'm GJ Mellett, actuary, pensions actuary at SNG Argent Actuarial Solutions. So it's great for me to host this day and facilitate. I want to ask our next speaker to come forward. As I said, we have not just a bunch of actuaries speaking to us today. So we will definitely have a few different viewpoints, etc. You can please take a seat. It's Naheem Essop. His current role is the Deputy Pension Funds Adjudicator. So I think a lot of us have dealt with the Pension Funds Adjudicator at some point in time. Some of them, I guess, positive, others not so positive. But we look forward to his insights. So he's an admitted attorney of the High Court of South Africa. Before his current role as the Deputy Pension Funds Adjudicator, he was a senior legal advisor, also at the office of the PFA. He was a specialist analyst at the FSCA, FSB. He was a practicing attorney for roughly 10 years, specifically advising certain municipal funds. So a lot of experience in retirement funds and the things that we deal with every day as well. And he was also an alternate member elected trustee on the FSCA pension fund. So Naheem, we really look forward to your presentation. Thank you for agreeing to speak to us, and I hope you don't get too many difficult questions at the end. So don't leave too much time for the room.
Thank you. I must say, as a lawyer coming to speak at the Actuarial Society conference, it's quite intimidating. I was saying to my colleague on the way here, this is where all the former State A students gather, and I'm not going to make any actuarial jokes. I thought I might make a lawyer joke, but my wife told me there's only 3 lawyer jokes. The rest of them are all true stories. So I'll stay away from that as well. Okay, so challenges members face in relation to market conduct within retirement funds. So this is a bit of a mouthful, and it's a topic that was given to me, so bear with me. But I thought we should talk about what is market conduct in the first place. If you look at the South African regulatory environment, there is the Twin Peaks model of regulation. And you have the Prudential Authority and you have the Financial Sector Conduct Authority. And it's the Conduct Authority really that has to deal with market conduct. And if you read the Financial Sector Regulation Act, you'll see that market conduct has something to do with promoting fair treatment of financial customers by financial institutions, financial education programs, financial literacy, and promoting sound financial decisions. Now, that first bullet point there relating to the fair treatment of financial customers by financial institutions is really what we have to deal with at the Office of the Pension Funds Adjudicator. And I thought I should start with some statistics to show the complaints that we receive on an annual basis. And you'll see that before COVID, we were hovering at around 11,000 complaints a year. And that is on average, I know I'm speaking to actuaries here, but it's on average of about 1,000 complaints a month if you take into account that we close during a period during December and January. and then after COVID, during COVID, the numbers went down, and we are starting to pick up and get back to pre-COVID levels. The 2023-2024 figures are not there, but the unaudited figures are also at about 9,200 complaints received in the last financial year. So that's quite a lot of complaints if you think about the members that are approaching our office to complain, and if you consider the size of our industry. And then the number of complaints that we've closed on an annual basis, again, you can see it's around 10,000. In the COVID year, I think it went up. Sorry, I don't know why those bars are not not reflective of the numbers, but you can see it in the COVID year, it actually went up because I think there was more time to deal with complaints. People were working from home. They didn't have to deal with walk-in clients, etc. And 23-24 is also up about 9,500 complaints closed a year. So we do have a mandate to ensure that we deal with complaints on an expeditious basis. And we have a KPI to close at least 85% of our complaints within 6 months and 100% of our complaints within 9 months. But there are exceptions, for example, when a fund is under going under some sort of regulatory intervention, like if it's under curatorship, etc., then that would affect the turnaround times. And currently, in the new financial year, we are sitting at about 90% of complaints closed within 6 months. So the complaints statistics, and these are the types of complaints that we receive. And you'll see that the majority there is relating to withdrawal benefits, 51.35%, relating to withdrawal benefits, and then Section 13A compliance, and that relates to the non-payment of contributions by pension funds. So the vast majority is relating to employers not paying contributions, because even within that statistic for withdrawal benefits, the member is dissatisfied with their benefit because contributions were not paid. And then there's debt benefits, Section 14 transfers, etc. Now, if we had to look at TCF outcomes, treating customers fairly, there isn't a standard that is out there relating directly to retirement funds. There is a standard that's there relating to other types of financial products. But we sort of created our own measures. And as you can see, the large majority is with claims or disbursements and service issues. And then the third one is relating to information provided by funds to members. So what are the challenges? Obviously, I did mention that there is the non-payment of contributions by employers. And the FSCA, some of you might know, did publish a name and shame list of employers that were not paying over their contributions. And in the first publication, it had 5,430 employers who were named and shamed for not paying contributions. Of that, about R1 billion in arrear contributions related to municipalities not paying contributions, and R6 billion relating to private companies. 28% of the employers had contributions outstanding for 1 month, and some of them were in arrears for more than 240 months. That's 20 years, which is more than it takes for you to pay off a bond. And then there was a second communication that the FSA issued, and it was more or less reflective of the same thing. It was a 183-page list of employers that have not paid, but it did seem to have some effect because some of the employers, after the name and shaming, did end up paying. So what is causing this? We do have Section 13A of the Pension Funds Act. There's the FSCA conduct standard that talks about what a retirement fund is supposed to do when an employer does not pay, or how they are supposed to detect it and report it to the board, and what action the board must take. There are timelines that must be adhered to. And there's also a criminal conviction or a criminal penalty if an employer does not pay their contributions. Then there's a very serious sanction that comes with it. You can be fined up to 10 million rand, or you can be imprisoned for up to 10 years, or you can have both. But we don't see that happening, and it doesn't seem like it is a deterrent. And there is, like I said, the Office of the Pension Funds Adjudicator. We do deal with these complaints, and it's a free service. So the challenge we have is that that funds are not reporting these non-compliances, or are not lodging complaints against employers that are not compliant. It appears to us that it's only when a member comes to us once they've withdrawn or they've retired, and they realize that their contributions have not been paid, and then we take up each employer on an individual basis. Instead of a fund detecting within the month that this employer has not paid, and then lodges one complaint against this employee in respect of all the affected employees. So that doesn't seem to be happening. And also, the number of cases being reported to the SAPS, there's not a lot, and that's also obviously a free service. And it seems like boards of funds are in a bit of a conflicted situation. Either if it's a standalone fund, the trustees work for the employer and therefore are reluctant to report their employer either to the OPFA or the SAPS, and they even have the option to go to court. Or even in a commercial umbrella fund, I think it doesn't look nice for business if you're seen to be taking your customers to the adjudicator or even to the SAPS. So there is a conflict there, and that's probably what's contributing to the non-payment of contributions or employees not paying over. Then another challenge we have is, especially with withdrawal benefits, we find these type of complaints mostly in retirement annuities, value for money products. And I've cited here an actual example of a teacher that was invested in a retirement annuity for 32 years. And the total amount of contributions that this teacher invested was just over 300,000. And they were paid out 274,000 at the end of the 32 years. This is after contributing regularly every month. But because the fund rules allow for these costs, we have no choice but to dismiss this claim. But you can see why members may not be incentivized to invest in a retirement annuity. So this is one of the things I thought I should bring to your attention, and especially with actuaries sitting in the room. Then communication with members. I think this is a big part of the challenge that we have in the industry. Starting with the arrear contributions, there is a legal requirement for funds to notify the affected members, but we find that doesn't happen, either because the fund doesn't have the contact details of the members, or the fund sends the communication to the employer. This is the same employer that has defaulted and has asked the employer to distribute it amongst the affected members. So that communication is failing. And it's also the same thing with benefit statements, because obviously on the benefit statements it will reflect whether contributions were paid or not. And if it's given to the defaulting employer, they're probably going to try to hide this from their employees. Members are not educated really about the role of a nomination form, and I'll talk towards the end of this presentation about some of the cases we dealt with. But it seems that members either don't understand what a nomination form is, or it seems that they need, or it seems that they haven't been explained that it's not something that is binding on a fund. So there's a very high expectation put on a nomination form. Spouses' entitlements in terms of marital regime, sometimes you get spouses coming and saying, I was married in community of property, therefore I must get 50% of the benefit. That is not how pension funds work. And this is part of communication that or education that funds need to provide to their members, and need to inform their members or provide more education about how an equitable distribution of a debt benefit works, that it is within the discretion of the trustees, but obviously taking into account relevant factors and ignoring irrelevant factors. And then retirement annuities, we do get a notable number of complaints where the member is not 55 yet, the member is not disabled, doesn't qualify to receive the retirement annuity benefit, but is trying to access that benefit. So it's obviously something that more education is needed on. These are the challenges I identified in relation to communication with members. Then we do have the two-pot system. I think everyone is fatigued with this two-pot system, but I tried to put it into like a formula for the actuaries. Two-pot equals vested component. So in the legislation, you'll see it says component, but then the entire system is referred to as two-pot system. Apparently, during the comments, someone didn't like the word pot. So we've got the word component in the system, and I think everyone more or less understands what or how the two-pot system works. But I think there is a challenge with the two-pot system insofar as communication is concerned. I think everyone focuses a lot on this early access that members are going to have, and I don't feel that members have been informed enough about the compulsory preservation part of it, and that is really the big change that has come in with two pots. And if you think about members accessing their savings pot during the first few years, and what impact we've been told even 1% has on a member's eventual retirement benefit. These early limited access there needs to be a lot of education, I think, around it. Members need to understand the tax implications. They need to understand the long-term effects of early access. And there should be some sort of projection or modeling that can enable them to make a cost-benefit analysis. Is it worth me taking out this 30,000 Rand less tax and what effect it has long term? And if we don't educate people now about compulsory preservation, I think it might have a very, very bad effect in the future. If you think about the e-tolls, for example, with e-tolls, people didn't know until it actually happened. And then government had to reverse it. Now, if you have the situation where members are accessing their savings pot and saving it, and for the first few years, they don't realize that there's this compulsory preservation aspect of it, and then you have a huge pushback against compulsory preservation, you can imagine what effect that will have if you have to climb back up from that. It's a steep hill to climb back up from if you're going to remove compulsory preservation. So this is something I think I don't see a lot of focus on in the media articles that I've read, and I do think that is something that funds can focus on going forward. Okay, some of the foreseeable two-pot issues: administration systems not being ready, including glitches and teething problems relating to seeding calculations, etc. I think the industry is aware of this. I think the dates were moved, and but we do foresee that there will be problems with the administration systems not being ready, or rule amendments not being adopted or registered on time to enable a member to access their early benefits. Delays in processing because members are going to have their tax numbers. Funds are going to have to apply for tax directives from SARS. Outstanding tax liabilities that might need to be paid before the benefit can be paid, bank verification, etc. And obviously fraudulent claims. I think this one is an important one, and I'm going to also talk about a few cases that we've dealt with where there were fraudulent claims. And this is something that I think funds need to be very wary of, especially when this two-pot system comes into effect. And then members not understanding if they don't have sufficient funds to withdraw, because there's a minimum amount that that they can withdraw. And so that's basically the challenges that we foresee with some of the two-pot issues. As the Office of the Pension Funds Adjudicator, we have an action plan in place for the two-pot systems. We're increasing capacity. We are doing training. We're collaborating with the FSCA. So we have a whole risk register and an action plan, and we are preparing ourselves as much as you would find administrators and funds preparing themselves for the two-pot system. Then some of the case law. I did say I was going to talk about the fraudulent cases. First one is the Mpambani versus Municipal Gratuity Fund and another. And this was where the member was incarcerated, and whilst the member was in prison, someone lodged a fraudulent claim against their benefit, and the fund paid that benefit out. And when the member got released, he wanted to then claim his benefit, and the fund said, sorry, we've paid it out already. And then he came to our office, and the adjudicator said the fund was supposed to be more careful and ordered the fund to pay the benefit to the member. So obviously that is a risk. And in this case, I think it was about 800,000 rand, the benefit. So it's quite a substantial amount. Private security sector, Provident Fund, and another. Okay, I didn't put the full name there. This is where a withdrawal benefit was claimed whilst the member was still employed and still contributing to the fund. So the member was employed from 2016 to 2023, but in 2020, someone had fraudulently claimed a withdrawal benefit against her benefit, And the fund paid it out without checking, notwithstanding that it is still receiving contributions on a monthly basis. And this is something funds need to be wary of. And I'm focusing on this a little bit because I'm worried about what could happen with the two-pot systems. And again, the fund was ordered to pay the benefit to the member. And then another case on the on fraudulent claims, the Tiengeza versus Funds at Work. The employer made a fraudulent claim in terms of 37D1B2. So that's where the member has committed theft, fraud, dishonesty, or misconduct. And the employer can claim a deduction either if they have a judgment or if they have a signed acknowledgement of debt in their favor. And in this case, the employer submitted a fraudulent claim against the member's benefit. And the fund relied on the good faith of the employer. It accepted the acknowledgement of liability, and it paid the complainant's full withdrawal benefit to the employer. And once again, the fund failed to take due care when doing this, failed to notice discrepancies in the acknowledgement of liability, and again, the adjudicator ordered the fund to pay the members full benefit. So you can see the type of things that can happen when dealing with withdrawal benefits, and these are some of the things that we need to find answers to in relation to the two-pot system and early access. Then I thought I should talk a little bit about some debt benefit matters. This one dealt with a nomination form and the role of a nomination form and what constitutes a valid nomination. So in this case, the deceased member had signed a nomination form in favor of his sister as collateral for a loan that she was going to advance to him. And that nomination form was submitted to the fund, but during the course of this negotiation between brother and sister for this loan, the deal fell apart. But also the fund had written back to the member's financial advisor saying that the nomination form is incomplete. There are certain things that need to be filled in. And the member, deciding that he's not proceeding with this, decided not to take it any further. But when the member died, then the fund relied on this nomination form, the same incomplete nomination form. And it was held that the nomination form was invalid and it was set aside, and the fund was ordered to reconsider the distribution of the benefit. Okay, then there is a matter relating to the withholding of a benefit in terms of Section 37D1B2 of the Act, and that relates to, as we just spoke about just now, relating to theft, fraud, dishonesty, and misconduct. And in this case, there was a criminal case that was instituted against the complainant and two others. And the employer had said by the time the complaint had been lodged with us that they were still in the process of commencing civil proceedings. But there was a decision to withhold by the fund, which was taken in October 2022. And then a further decision to continue with the withholding in October 2023. So you can imagine there was quite a lapse of time between when the member exited and when they eventually came to our office. And in between that time, there had been no civil proceedings. The fund decided to withhold without giving the member an opportunity to be heard. As we know, the Audi Alteram Partem principle applies to the withholding of benefits. And so the fund was then ordered to pay out the member's benefit. One of the issues here was when responding to the complaint, the fund actually responded on its own behalf, but also on behalf of the employer. And that was something that was frowned upon by the adjudicator because a fund is supposed to act in an impartial manner when it comes to these disputes between the member and the employer. And something to note is that criminal proceedings on its own is insufficient to justify the withholding of a benefit. There must be civil proceedings, either imminent or pending civil proceedings. Obviously, there are certain cases where the delay in instituting civil proceedings might be justifiable, but then the fund must record that in its minutes when it's called upon to explain its decision, then it must do so. Okay, then this case, I think it's the last one, but it's Kotana versus All Mutual Super Fund, unclaimed benefits. So what happened in this matter was there was a member who had died whilst he was a member of the original fund, and his benefit, and then the fund decided to do a Section 37C investigation. It could not trace or identify beneficiaries, and it eventually took a decision to pay the benefit to an unclaimed benefit fund. And then when the unclaimed benefit fund was holding this benefit, it managed to trace certain beneficiaries. And the complainant in this matter was arguing with the fund about paying the beneficiary's benefits into a third-party bank account, and the fund wanted to pay it into the estate. Both of the arguments were centered around the unclaimed benefit doing a Section 37C investigation. So the adjudicator held that the duty to apply the provisions of Section 37C rested with the original fund. And then once that fund had taken a decision to pay it into the unclaimed benefit fund, there was no further duty for the unclaimed benefit fund to conduct another Section 37C investigation. But this would have been different if the member's benefit was paid into the unclaimed benefit fund and then the member died after the transfer. And then there would have been a duty on the unclaimed benefit fund to conduct a Section 37C investigation. And since the deceased estate had since been reported, the unclaimed benefit was then required to be paid into the estate laid bank account. So I think that is it. Thank you very much, and I'm happy to take questions.
Great. Thank you very much, Naeem, for that insightful presentation. I hear your concerns with the two-pot or two-component system coming in, where we were used to a single payment from a fund to a member at retirement or at withdrawal. Now you're almost going to have annual payments to a lot of members. So that will create a lot of extra work for you. So what can the industry do to prevent that? Because we're talking about communication and education, but what can we do to really let members understand and to limit those claims? Because it will not only impact your office, it will be an impact on the administrators, on the consultants, and everyone involved in the industry.
Yeah, I think the key is education. I think, and also being very realistic in that education, you know, saying to members there is this possibility that we might not be ready on the 1st of September. Or even if we are ready, that there still might be delays in processing these benefits. Because I think a lot of members are already planning what they're doing with that money. And they expect to be paid on the 1st of September. So I think that needs to be, the education needs to be a bit more intense about what the issues are that could arise on the 1st of September, so that, you know, expectations are managed a bit. But I mean, other than that, is you've got to ensure that your rules are registered on time with the FSCA, and obviously ensure that your administration system is ready to deal with these claims. So,
Great. Yep. I see we have a few questions already and a few online.
More of a comment than a question. I love the idea of doing modeling around, you know, when people withdraw their savings benefits to show the impact on retirement. The challenge is we don't know where and how people are going to be applying that money. If someone's applying that money to credit card debt where they're paying 22%, you know, taking the savings benefit makes financial sense. But we're not going to know that, and I don't know if anyone's planning on collecting or tracing the money or seeing where it's going to go. Do anyone know?
Yes, it's interesting because I just recently wrote an article on the two-pot system, and I put in there, members should at all costs be discouraged from withdrawing. And my boss said to me, no, you can't say to members that they are not entitled to what they are entitled to in terms of the legislation. The legislation does not have any qualification about what you can use this money for. It's unlike home loans, you must use it for to improve your home or renovations or whatever the case is. But if you look at... in Australia, I think it was, there's an article by the University of Melbourne that says at least 11% of the members that withdrew this money in Australia used it for gambling. So it's the legislation is what it is at the moment, and we just have to keep educating and showing them at the point when they decide that they want to do this, that this is what the effect is going to be on your retirement at the end of your term.
Okay, we have another question there at the back. And just ask, if you have a question, just state your name and company, and then you can ask the question.
Yes. Hello. My name is Comfort from the FSCA. So my question is with regards to the complaints, you know. Given that there's like 1,000 complaints a year, that's not the whole picture, given that other people don't complain. Probably complains about a third of people that actually are affected by the situation. So given that those complaints are with regards to withdrawal benefits, and then reason being employers not paying, so what is the industry doing about that to solve that problem, given that it has been occurring for some time now? So yes, thank you.
Yeah, so you're from the FSCA, and whenever I go to conferences, people put up their hands and say, what is the FSCA doing about it? but the FSCA, it's not really the FSCA's duty to do something about it. The legislation says it's the trustees, and it gives you the specific timelines, etc. I think what the FSCA can do is to hold trustees accountable for not implementing the regulations. I think that, from the FSCA's perspective, would be more effective. I think the naming and shaming did have an effect, but it probably was more because the funds that didn't take action decided now it's time for us to do something about these unpaid contributions. But yeah, I think it has to be a joint effort, and there has to be collaboration with the stakeholders like the SAPS, to ensure that these, when criminal complaints are lodged, that it is taken to completion, so that there is a deterrent for employers who are not paying over contributions. Thanks.
Hi, Nick Gibbs from Robson Savage. Just wanted to, from your perspective, actuaries' responsibility is to protect customers. So let me just give you a bit of background, the context for the question. So, recently, as a consultant to a particular fund, presenting on this particular fund's, or the fund I was a consultant to, their benefit structure, with another fund presenting on theirs for the members to choose in a kind of open transfer window between the two funds. Conscious from my side of the challenges that members faced on the other side, a particular fund that even the PFA has raised concerns about. You're saying there's names and naming and shaming, but to what extent would you expect actuaries to warn members when we already know that, say, the PFA or the FSCA already has that particular fund under scrutiny. So it may be professional to warn the members, but it might also be unprofessional to do so from the perspective of looking like you're just trying to get members to your fund.
Yes. So there is a section of the Act, I'm trying to think which section it is, but relating to actuaries and their whistleblowing obligations. So they do have to, if they pick up something that could be of detriment to the members, they do have an obligation to report it to the FSCA. It's the same with auditors, it's the same with trustees, with principal officers. So there is that, and I suppose that would be the route that an actuary that picks up something should take. They should report it to the FSCA.
My name is Francis from NPC Holdings. Just a comment and a suggestion. I think with regards to the two-pot system, the focus at the point is really in accessing the money, the savings pot. I think, like you said, the element of the retirement pot, the forced preservation, is not being discussed enough. I think there's to be more communication on that aspect, and we are likely, I foresee 20, 30 years down the line, that element being reversed, because assume someone has been taking their money on a yearly basis from the savings pot and they lose a job at the age of 35 and can't find another job. Are they going to wait to 55 to access that money? So I just see that section probably being reversed in the next 20, 30 years. And then the other point that I just want to make as a suggestion, he highlighted the issue of the contributions where funds are struggling. We are getting a lot of complaints because of members not, employers not paying contributions. Why can't maybe as government or as a regulator, they centralize that aspect of compliance? So instead of employers or funds being the one with the responsibility of pursuing employers, why not that being done at a regulator level? Because when funds go to police station, the police don't even know what to do. So it's better if it is done maybe at a regulator point of view. And I do think it might be cost effective.
Yes, no, I absolutely agree with you on the preservation, the education around preservation. And I think it's sort of going to come in gradually because of the vested pot. So when members retire now in the next few years, they won't actually realize that they're not entitled to a withdrawal benefit anymore. But you can imagine a miner, someone working in a mine, and then they get retrenched. And then they've got no money to feed their family. And you can imagine the type of social consequences that has. And whether that's going to start a movement to reverse this compulsory preservation, and what the impact of reversing that would be very, very serious, I think. Yeah, insofar as the arrear contributions and centralizing it, etc., I did have some idea about that as well, but I was told in terms of funding this type of model, it wasn't feasible, but I suppose that's a question for actuaries to answer. So, yes. Thanks.
Do we have one last question from the floor? Nobody. Then I'm just quickly going to read through some of the online comments or questions. The first one, I'll read all three of them, Naheem, and then you can maybe respond.
Sure.
The first one is asking for an update on when the two-pot amendments to the PFA will be signed by the President. But I think not even you will know that answer. Then another one, more a question for the FSCA, is providing financial customers with financial education, looking at this two-pot complaints that's coming in. And this attendee is asking what is the FSCA doing about that? And then the other one, what will a fund have to do if the two-part amendments has been submitted but not yet approved by the 1st of September? no payment with extremely dissatisfied, agitated members. And I expect that will be the case for a lot, because I know today is a kind of the deadline for submissions.
Yes.
And there's, I think, quite a few funds that will not be submitting today, so they will probably last in line for approvals. Any comments on those?
Yeah, the date of signature, I'm still waiting for Kofi to come in, so I don't know when that would that will happen. But on the rule amendments, I suppose the FSCA does have some sort of contingency plan for late submissions. I remember I was there when we were dealing with the default regulations, and funds waited until the last minute to submit the rule amendments or exemptions from the default regulations. I'm sure the FSCA has got some plan in place. We've got some colleagues here from the FSCA. They could probably enlighten us on that. Yeah.
Maybe just a last question on the arrear contributions, which we saw from the complaints is a huge issue, but especially from municipalities, as you said. What's your experience with dealing with the municipalities and their funds to actually pay these contributions? Why does it? It's a state entity. It shouldn't be such a big issue. They should just pay their contributions. And it's also very difficult to report a case to SAPS. It's a free service, but you get the runaround. You just can't get someone to actually report this case about arrear contributions.
Yeah. So with municipalities, I think it differs from fund to fund. It depends on which fund is servicing that municipality, because if a fund is run properly, you find hardly any arrear contributions. I think Arthur Els is here, Natal Joint, you hardly find that. And when there is, then action is taken very quickly. And then there are other funds that just allow it to escalate. So it really ultimately comes down to the attitude of the trustees and whether they're willing to pursue these things. Sorry, I forgot your second part.
No, just on the reporting that to SAPS. But
yes, yeah. So that was a challenge that was identified by the FSCA. And I know that they've been having engagements with the FSCA, with the SAPS, to equip the SAPS to deal with these type of complaints. So I suppose if a fund is not getting any joy, they could maybe make contact with someone at the FSCA and see who would be the right person at SAPS to speak to about these complaints. Yeah.
Great. Thank you very much for this. Really appreciate it. And I think we all learned a lot and are a bit uneasy about what's coming for us.
Yes.
But thanks for your time and getting out here to talk to us.
Thank you.